It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're talking about efforts to diversify so-called STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. National and private organizations, they've invested millions of dollars in science diversity programs in recent years, really trying to shake up these long-established norms that are ingrained in academic science departments. And we're checking in on the campus climate and what it means for STEM in Wisconsin and across the country. Teachers and researchers, what do you do to try to get students from all backgrounds interested in STEM fields? How do you make it more inclusive? Are there barriers to the scientific academy that you see and others around you, they don't? They're blind to it. Let's talk about this. 800-642-1234. Ginger Ann is executive director of the Illuminating Discover Hub at UW-Madison. It works to establish connections between scientists and the public. Ginger Ann, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
So your legal name is Ginger Ann Contreras, and you don't use that last name. Why is that?
Correct. Thank you for asking. So a lot, what you'll see on the panel, we have the Who Owns Science panel coming up today at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. And so in those announcements, you'll see my last name. But when you see my email, you'll see my sign-off is Ginger Ann. And the reason why is I use my middle name as a placeholder to recognize that Contreras is a part of the culture, the Spanish conquistador culture of my ancestry. And those values don't fit with my personal values of the First Nation side of my ancestry. So my Spanish side, that Contreras last name, and how there was a systematic oppression and also a silencing of my First Nation culture, language, is really important for me to recognize. And so I do that by not leading with my last name and instead having my middle name. A part of that is my grandmother was a healer, and she carried on some of those First Nation practices from her grandparents. But she lost language. We know it's the Apache tribe, but we don't know what tribe it is. So it's a really important part for me to recognize that there's been that level that's been silenced. And my personal goal is doing research so I can hope to find that and reclaim.
Why do we see so few women and minorities in scientific fields?
That's a great question. Part of it has to do with the culture, the historical culture of STEM fields. And another part of it has to do with the values. So there's a lot of differences and nuances depending on the cultures that you're coming from, as well as gender. And they all play a role into how you're relating to science and how you're pursuing your academic field. So a level being, from my personal experience, being of a First Nation ancestry, it's really important to be connected to people and help with leading by inspiring leaders so that you are leading together. With that, when you're in a lab, it feels isolated. You're not connected to people. And although the research can serve people, that isolation can make it feel, are you really doing something that fits with your values? And so a part of STEM inclusion and diversity is how are we opening up the scholarship and research so that you can start to have more of that connection to people and start to see that your values do align and have a welcoming atmosphere. Also goes down to gender. I've had many people in my background, which is bioarchaeology, say, but you're too pretty to be a bioarchaeologist. Oh. My looks have nothing to do with it. Or, wow, you speak so well. And that leaves the concept of they're surprised that I'm able to communicate about STEM, like somehow this isn't something that I should be a specialist in. So those all are messaging of who belongs and who owns science.
We're talking with Ginger Ann of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery about diversity in STEM fields, and you can join in. Are you a woman working in science? What was your experience breaking into the field? Do you feel like you've had the same opportunities at school or at your job? Teachers and professors, are you trying to get students from all backgrounds interested in pursuing science? How do you do that? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ginger, it may be easy to see how different cultural backgrounds can shape creative fields like the arts and music and literature, but we do, as you said, think about the lab in science, that isolating lab and the precise numbers and formulas and methods that just are they don't give, that they're so clearly defined. How do you see an individual's identity or your heritage affecting that precise scientific research? What's the connection?
The value of that is our diversity is really our strength. So when you have different scientists that are coming from different backgrounds, they're actually looking at the research differently. And so by doing that, you can create innovative discovery that never would have happened if you're only approaching it from a Western standpoint. So an example being there's a linguistic anthropology concept that your language shapes how you're viewing the world. So an example being when you have languages that don't use numbers, they're going to see a different pattern when you have several sets of, let's say, chickens, where if you're seeing numbers, you're going to see specific numbers. So there's ways that you start to see trends and pick up on things. And so by bringing people together that have diverse thought, they're going to notice patterns and be able to point them out to each other to advance that scholarship. So there is a great benefit that we're missing in science when we're not allowing people to express their diversity and how they're approaching their research.
For decades, crash test dummies were only designed to represent male bodies, and yet research has shown that women are far more likely to be seriously injured in a car crash than a man. What are the dangers of homogeneous engineering and design teams?
Mm-hmm. Safety. It comes down to, I mean, there's a huge level of how are we creating an inclusive culture that is going to be safe and accessible and also nurturing of all people. So when you do that, you're cutting out on many different levels, whether it's the, you know, these crash dummies, that's a safety concern. When you're looking at medicines, that's also a safety concern, because when you're only having test groups of white males, the medicines that you have are going to be aligned with their genetics, their environment, and it's going to be successful for what their background is, not a person of color. So there's, you know, these classic comparisons and differences that are really important for making sure we're serving all of our community. And when you look at it, there's the estimates that in 2050, 50% of the U.S. population is going to be people of color. So if we're not engaging people now, we're going to be missing the STEM professionals that we need in the future, and we're going to be missing serving people and our quality of health as a community and as a population, as a country, because we haven't done the work we need to do.
We haven't done the work we need to do, but do you think we have clearly identified the issue? Are we taking diversity in STEM fields seriously, and are we acting on it?
We are, and in different pockets we're acting on it. I think one of the most important things is we don't have all the answers yet, otherwise we would have solved this. So we're still in that conversation of what can we do, and that testing. There's going to be some programs that are successful now that are not going to be relevant in 10 years from now, because we're going to be in a different culture, we're going to be in a different place. So there are great programs. One of the programs we're doing here on campus is Science to Street Art, where we're creating street art murals throughout the city of Madison. We're pairing scientists with street artists and using graffiti art as a theme to communicate science to youth. So we're trying to find ways to engage community and change the lens of how we're telling the story of science for our future STEM, and engaging new STEM stakeholders, whether or not their education background is in science or their legacy is in science. We want to make sure this is inclusive. Other programs that we have with Wisconsin Institute for Discovery are led by grad students, where they're looking at grad student mental health, and a part of that being diversity of how are we nurturing our future leaders in these fields. So there are great things both here on campus and nationally that are happening, but we still got work to do.
We're talking with Ginger Ann from the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, looking at diversity in science, what it means to bring more people of different backgrounds into the academy, into science programs that fall far short of gender and racial diversity. Did you ever want to be a scientist when you grew up? Who or what changed your mind? Researchers, have you broken new ground in your scientific studies because of a perspective you brought that was different than your peers at the table? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Back in a moment. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about diversity in STEM fields and why it matters. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. These fields have forever lacked diversity in race and gender. And here's a statistic. If you tally up all of the Nobel Prizes in the sciences throughout time, in all of history, the awards have been given to only 21 women. That's 3% of the 700 Nobel laureates. So are you a woman working in science? What was your experience breaking into your field? Do you feel like you've had the same opportunities at school or at your job? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ginger Ann runs the Illuminating Discovery Hub at UW-Madison, and she stays with us. Ginger, if we want to diversify science, what needs to change about the way we teach it? I mean, I hear you saying street art and mental health. These are really different things. And so what are you seeing as some breakthroughs?
In terms of instruction, it's being open to different concepts and cultural reactions and perspectives to what you're teaching. It's also a level of opening up and immediately connecting how it relates to people when you have cultures that value for your future, for your job, for what you want to do as a person in this life, having the power to be able to help people and lead and lift. When you want that to be so close to what you're doing, having instructors, your mentors, talk about how that is going to be impacted through the science and how your science can do that, and having a different way of how are we structuring lab time, how are we structuring outreach so that there's a bit more balance. A part of that too is representation. A huge part of it is what you were mentioning, is that we don't have a lot of women in certain STEM fields. We don't have a lot of people of color leading certain STEM fields. And so it sends a messaging of whether or not you'll be successful within those fields. So part of the instruction is also seeing yourself reflected. And that happens in the classroom. It can happen with making sure that when you're talking about science, you're talking about different ways of including science. So one thing that's really important for my culture, coming from a First Nation culture, my grandma being a healer, there's an interesting concept within our family, because my grandma had no education, no formal education. She didn't have the opportunity to go to kindergarten, but she was so advanced within her healing practices. But her healing practices merged medicine, herbs, with spirituality. And it's really hard because in the sciences, spirituality can be scoffed at, or that it's not taken as seriously.
A non-starter.
Absolutely. And it can alienate you, feeling this isn't a place for me. This type of research isn't going to fulfill me and respect my culture. So how are we taking those different lenses and approaching science in a different way when we're talking about it that's more inclusive and accepting of people's viewpoints, their practices, and the scientist and the student as a whole? So that's a big part of the education format. Another part is creating more of a dialogue when you're teaching science. And then another level, Joe Handelsman, the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, which houses our Illuminating Discovery Hub. One of her big pushes is Tiny Earth, which is a program that is for student crowdsourcing antibiotic discovery. And one thing that she talks about a lot as a teacher and as an instructor in STEM and a woman in STEM is how are we looking at activating students within this scientific discovery portion while they're learning. Because a lot of the education, you're learning these facts, you're not really partaking in being a scientist. And so if you can immediately have them be a part of the process so that they're realizing, hey, I can be a scientist because I'm doing it right now, that creates the power that you can see yourself reflected when there isn't representation immediately available regarding your identity and who you are as a person.
It's almost like you want to kind of fast forward into being able to do the science and feel the science instead of having to step back and say, oh, no, wait, before you do any of that, you got to learn this and this and this. It also reminds me that one person can make a huge difference in someone's life. Like one moment can change a person's path.
Absolutely. And going a little bit broader in that, one of our programs, Science to Script, which was inspired by Jo Handelsman's work when she was a science advisor during the Obama administration, is looking at how are we representing science and inclusion and diversity and representation of diverse scientists within mass media, like big budget films and Hollywood. So this links to what you're talking about as well, because what you start to see is that there's a limited amount of women and people of color represented in STEM fields within film. And so what is it showing you about the role models you have? Because what you find is if you don't have a scientist within your family or a role model or someone to connect to when you're young, you're often being introduced to STEM fields through media. So an example being the Gina Davis Institute partnered with the Lyda Hill Foundation to create a study of 10 years of the top grossing films that were related to science. And these were a couple of data sets. 37.1% of STEM characters were women. And then what stuck out for me is less than 4% of those STEM characters were Latinx, and even smaller Latinx women. And for me, who's multiracial, has Spanish First Nation ancestry, it was so important of looking at that and seeing I wasn't ever seeing myself reflected. And when you start to see films now, there is a big push for inclusion and diversity, and starting to see myself reflected, the culture, the people, it's empowering. And so by having more, how are we expanding into film? How are we increasing representation that might not be there physically within the fields right now? It's inspiring the next generations by role models that you see on screen or the play, you know, or the stage.
We're talking with Ginger Ann about diversity and inclusion in science, and she'll be speaking at the Wisconsin Science Festival in Madison later today. What do you want to know about diversity in scientific fields? What's your take on how labs and research organizations can flex to be more inclusive? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ginger, thinking about the Nobel Prize and that statistic that just 3% of women have been Nobel laureates, you know, even from the greatest science academy in the, you know, from a worldview, is also really trying to figure out how to shake things up. So some of that has to filter down, and it takes time. But what can we look to our whole world as we look at how to diversify STEM here in the United States?
It's engaging STEM stakeholders that might not have a science background, and a level of being open to where are we seeing when we as a people are pushing these Western norms of who is a leader, because people of color and then also women, there's a different way of leading. You see that it's a level of service. And when you're serving and you're trying to help encourage and support and lift others, it can be really hard to be recognized for areas like the Nobel. So there's, you know, so it's really interesting of how are we as people also promoting and getting interested, because if we're starting to support our women scientists, if we're starting to support people of color in the science fields or the pursuit of the science, that is where we're going to start to see that power and that change happen. So a part of it comes from us as a whole.
Let's go to Mike now in La Crosse with thoughts on this. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm fortunate I work for a Fortune 500 company in the La Crosse area that encourages STEM activities for people in our company, specifically women in our company. Donna and Kristen are two great examples, and they get out to the high schools. We've invested tens of thousands of dollars in local education to encourage specifically women to enter the engineering field. But we also belong to national organizations like Women in Manufacturing that really promote within our company, but also allow us to promote within the communities we're in. Organizations like that that really open people and, as you said earlier, identify with younger students in high school and college that there are women in these positions and that they're not the only ones, and to encourage them to support and go for those opportunities.
So Mike there in the private sector at a Fortune 500 company, he sees his company making strides in this and reaching out into the community.
Absolutely. And I think it's incredibly important what Mike just mentioned, too, that there are organizations. So helping to connect, to be a part of those organizations, to find the support that's out there is really important when you're pursuing your field. If you're a young professional, mid-professional, and any stage of STEM, that's really important.
What can private companies do to address STEM and the diversity in their workforce?
I think what Mike mentioned, it's going out to the schools, communicating the research you're doing, also supporting universities or representation within film, just different ways of how you're talking about your research, how it apply your business, talking about how it applies to community as a whole, and listening and being responsive to the needs of the students and their cultural backgrounds and that diversity.
You have mentioned through our conversation a number of innovative programs that you're trying out, everything from street art to all these various things. But how do you know that they'll be working, that they're making a difference? How do you measure that?
That's a great question. As pilots, that's where we're having an agile approach because you don't know how they're going to work when you're first starting them out. We do have measurements where we're working off of public art standards for how, for the murals specifically, how to create impact, and then where do you put them locationally. We also are building informal learning opportunities, and we're partnering with specialists that are looking at analysis of how you create impact. So some of it is the test, and then you got to study it, and then we'll know, and then you adapt from there.
Ginger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Ginger, and she is Executive Director for the Illuminating Discovery Hub at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. She'll be speaking at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery in Madison today at 2 o'clock as part of the Wisconsin Science Festival. And we talked about the future of STEM fields and how to address the inequality along racial and gender lines. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about living with dementia, and we have a geriatric psychiatrist to look at the challenges around quality of life for persons with dementia and their caregivers. Dementia is a decline in mental function that interferes with daily life. There are different types of dementia, with Alzheimer's disease among the most common. And because dementia is progressive, treatment focuses on controlling symptoms. We're learning more with UW-Madison geriatric psychiatrist Art Walasek. He's a dementia care expert. Let's go to the phones now. Mark is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Hello. First of all, I want to say I'm not contemplating suicide, but I have a friend who says if he was diagnosed with dementia, he would commit suicide. He says part of living well is dying well, and dying with dementia, he thinks, is not a good way to die. Does he have a viable point?
What a great question. Thank you, Mark. We take threats of suicide very, very seriously. So older adults in particular are actually at higher risk of suicide than younger adults, in particular older men. So, you know, I certainly appreciate the sentiment that I'd rather die than have this illness. But we usually, when we hear suicide statements, we think about depression, we think about anxiety, pain, insomnia, all things that could contribute to life feeling like it's not worth living. And so we really go for trying to get mental health treatment. If there's an imminent threat, something's urgent, then getting them into an ER or into a physician right away to get them evaluated, because we can save a life. It's suicide is unfortunately, rates of suicide have been climbing in the U.S. over the last few years, but this is largely a preventable condition by addressing things like depression, anxiety, and insomnia. And, you know, not to be a Pollyanna, but many people with dementia live very good, positive, enjoyable lives. They can still enjoy time with their family.
There is hope.
Absolutely. People can be creative. It can be a time for reflection about your family and your life and contributions and so on. So, you know, it's not just like a switch that flips and all of a sudden you have this terrible illness. People can still enjoy things quite a bit. And there is hope. There's research going on all the time trying to find a cure for Alzheimer's disease. So we here at UW, we've got the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, both doing tons of research on trying to identify causes of dementia and then treatments of dementia.
Mark, thanks so much for the call. Laura from Madison couldn't stay with us, but wants to know if someone they know is becoming forgetful or perhaps showing signs of dementia, what should be those first steps to take?
What a great question. So I think first off, I would have that person go see their primary care doctor, whoever is the person primarily responsible for their medical care, because they're going to need an evaluation of medical causes of memory loss. For example, we don't often think about this, but sleep apnea, a condition where at night you don't breathe very well, that can cause memory problems, problems with your thyroid. There's a whole list of potential medical issues. Depression as well. Depression can cause cognitive impairment. So you get a two-way street between memory loss and depression. We look at medications very closely. We look at things like alcohol, so excessive amounts of alcohol use can contribute to memory problems. So there's a long list of possibilities that a primary care doctor could look at. And I would add that in Wisconsin, we're very fortunate to have a wonderful network of folks called dementia care specialists. So most counties in Wisconsin will have a dementia care specialist. It's complicated. It's difficult navigating the system. And so a family member, a person who's worried about their memory can call a dementia care specialist and start walking through those steps of how they might get evaluated.
Oh, they're kind of like a guide through the process and actually helping you connect you with resources.
Exactly.
We had another comment here. Monica emailed us, and she says she's watched loved ones suffer and die from dementia. There's intense anxiety. And Monica says it was heartbreaking. As Monica ages, wondering what they can do to make it easier for the children if it happens. What can they do in advance medically, financially, otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, those dementia care specialists work quite a bit with family members. There are many organizations. There's the Alzheimer's Association. There's another group called the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance of Wisconsin that do a lot of family and caregiver education and support. We're not quite sure what we can do to prevent dementia, but we have some good ideas like exercise, reducing the amount of alcohol use, treating things like diabetes and high blood pressure, quitting smoking. There might be some dietary modifications like getting closer to a Mediterranean-style diet. So those are then some of the things that someone could do in terms of they're worried that they might develop dementia because they've seen a family member go through it. Those are some lifestyle steps that they could take to try to address that.
We're talking with Dr. Art Walasek. He's a geriatric psychiatrist and a dementia care expert. What are your questions about mental health care and dementia? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Walasek, geriatric patients can administer cognitive tests to diagnose dementia. The psychiatrist can. Do we have enough specialists to meet the demands out there?
So the short answer is no. We have an aging population and more people with dementia. So we are trying many different things to get the people who older adults go to see to get them aware of and understanding how to recognize and diagnose dementia. So again, that'll include primary care doctors. That could include all sorts of other people in the community. For example, we have a program at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute where we're working with emergency medical technicians on helping them recognize signs of dementia and getting people referred into programs. Home health nurses, we have another program working with them. So there's a wide network of people that we could work with to help with identification.
Let's bring in Michael now, joining us from Appleton. Hi, Michael.
Hi. So I just had more of a comment. Both my fraternal grandparents had various forms of dementia. My grandmother, slower decline through Alzheimer's, and my grandfather with a rather more surprising and much more rapid decline through dementia with Lewy bodies. And they were both in assisted living for a number of years before passing. And they were eventually moved to one that was just down the street from my aunt, their daughter, so she could, regularly see them. And it just was impactful to me seeing my aunt and having talked to her since how hard the disease can be on family members and especially on the primary family caretaker.
How can caregivers take care of themselves?
Michael, great question. I'm very sorry to hear about the family members and the experiences that you've all had. Yeah, I think self-care is critical. You know, there's that sort of the adage about put your mask on first before assisting others. I mean, I think it's really important for caregivers to take care of themselves. They may need respite help. They may need a break. It's very hard. You know, you see a loved one suffering, you want to help them out. But if someone's not doing their own self-care, they're going to get burnt out. It's going to be very, very difficult. So we often ask family members to divide responsibilities among each other. There'll be home health agencies. There are helpers who can come in. So there can be a wide variety of different people who can come in and give those family members a break.
Matt from Wausau emailed us to ask about the promise, perhaps, of psychedelics for treating depression and dementia. What do we know there?
I don't know a whole lot about psychedelics for depression and dementia. There is some research underway for depression. I don't know of anything related to dementia, unfortunately.
Well, let's go to Teresa now. Teresa, good morning.
Good morning.
What is on your mind about dementia?
So my mother was diagnosed with dementia like 2 years ago, and she's already passed due to the disease. Mm-hmm. What is the likelihood of someone in the family getting dementia?
Teresa,
Alzheimer's?
I'm so sorry to hear about you and about your mother. It depends somewhat on the type of dementia. So in general, with Alzheimer's disease, there is an increased risk of children getting Alzheimer's disease, but it's not 100% guarantee. So it increases the risk, but it doesn't mean that for sure the person's going to get dementia. And again, it could be a prompt to, okay, well, what are things that I could do lifestyle-wise to reduce my risk, including exercise and dietary changes and things like that.
Well, Teresa, thanks for the call. And Dr. Walasek, as we wrap up here, what is the biggest unanswered question right now we have when it comes to dementia patients who are also dealing with mental health issues?
Well, I think the biggest issue is how can we help this ever-growing population of people with dementia who also suffer from depression, anxiety, insomnia, and so on? And it's clear that we need kind of a complex intervention that's going to involve looking at what are things that we can try to fix here, that we can reverse, getting people support, addressing caregivers as well. And then we just need more research. We need to understand better why these illnesses arise and hopefully soon find a cure for Alzheimer's disease and other causes of dementia.
Dr. Art Walasek is a board-certified geriatric psychiatrist and professor of psychiatry at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also president of the American Association of Directors of Psychiatric Residency Training, and his new book addresses behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia for clinicians. Coming up, you have a line to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. What do you think about President Trump pulling troops from Syria? What questions do you have for Senator Baldwin? What should the senator prioritize as far as issues in Wisconsin? We have an open line for you to Senator Tammy Baldwin right now. What are your thoughts and questions? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back in a moment with Senator Baldwin right here on the Ideas Network. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're having a conversation with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin here on The Morning Show. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin has represented Wisconsin since 2013. Senator Baldwin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's a delight to join you. Thank you so much.
So you say it was a mistake for President Trump to pull American forces from Syria, as we've seen Turkish forces were preparing to advance against U.S. allies and, you know, Kurdish militia. Why do you disagree with the president's decision?
Well, we should be working with our allies to create less conflict in the Middle East, but this decision by the president has created a very dangerous, frankly, a mess in Syria. And it has put a lot of folks at grave risk, including the very real prospect that ISIS will become stronger again, that it's a move that places the region and U.S. interests in grave jeopardy. And to turn the U.S. Back on the Kurds who fought with us to take the caliphate away from ISIS is a grave mistake that has long-term consequences.
So would you support sending U.S. troops back into Syria right now?
You know, I think the president needs to reverse his decision. And at this point, we have to do everything we can to stabilize a very chaotic circumstance. So I was traveling in the region in Turkey and was, I think, thoroughly briefed on what was at stake there immediately prior to the president's tweet. Frankly, this came out of a tweet from the president. And recognized that there were a number of, over 10,000 ISIS fighters and immediate family right in the region that we're talking about, that we risked seeing those individuals escape or just be released, and creating a much more dangerous situation in that region.
Very quickly here, as before we move on to other topics, with the withdrawal of troops, we've seen Russian troops have stepped in. What kind of effect will that have on the region? Because Turkey and Russia haven't been allies. Do you think President Trump defers too much to Russia when it comes to foreign policy issues like this?
Well, I think that there is a consequence to these actions that have resulted in the strengthening of Assad in Syria, the strengthening of the Russians, the strengthening of ISIS, and the strengthening of Iran. This is the the consequence of what President Trump has done here. And right now, Turkey is a NATO ally, but has been working increasingly with Russia, including a very controversial purchase of anti-missile battery from Russia that puts a lot of other relationships at risk. So we've been seeing this gradual increase in Russia and Turkey working together. Who knows what's going to happen between the two nations when Russia is patrolling the Turkish border from the Syrian side. But that is what's happening as the Russian forces have been in Syria in a different part of the country for some time.
We're catching up with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. Let's look at the impeachment inquiry for a moment. President Trump asked foreign leaders to investigate the Bidens. The president says he was attempting to fight corruption. Do you believe the president should be impeached?
Well, the White House call memo that they released summarizing a July call between our president and the president of the Ukraine puts it out pretty clearly. He was inviting foreign interference in our 2020 election. He was also working with a foreign government to discredit the work of American law enforcement and intelligence relating to protecting the integrity of our elections dating back to the 2016 elections. And these actions by the president really put at risk both our national security and the security of our American elections. So I support this impeachment inquiry, And I am very disturbed to see the president obstruct Congress from doing its job. Nobody's above the law. The president is not above the law.
You were on the Senate floor this week talking about legislation to protect the pensions of 25,000 workers and retirees in Wisconsin. And I think Gary in Madison has a question to that. Gary, hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Just wondering where this situation is going with this failing Central States Pension Fund that we've all worked very hard to achieve, and it seems to be disappearing before our very eyes. What's going on with that?
Senator Baldwin.
Yeah. Well, the Central States Pension Fund is on the verge of becoming insolvent, and almost all of the nearly 25,000 retirees in Wisconsin have gotten letters to the effect that their pensions will be cut if no action is taken, sometimes by as much as 50, 60, or 70%. And I can't imagine what it was like for families to get a letter like that when they're well into their retirement and don't really even have the option of going back to work and accumulating additional savings. We've been working for three plus years to try to create a solution. I have worked with colleagues to introduce the Butch Lewis Act, named in honor of a retired Central State pensioner who worked tirelessly to try to fix this problem. The House passed the Butch Lewis Act nearly 3 months ago, and this week we have been urging the leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, to bring it up in the Senate for a vote so that we can get this legislation signed into law to finally protect the retirement security of these retirees and their families. In addition, this week I introduced my legislation to help shore up the government's insurance plan for these pensions. The Pension Stability Act would add additional funding to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is the government's insurance plan for pensions, both single employer pensions and Central States, which is a multi-employer pension. And I have to say that, you know, tragically, as these workers face impending cuts to their pensions, so does the government insurance plan, the PBGC. It faces very serious shortfalls in funding. And so my Pension Stability Act would help alleviate some of that by creating revenue for that fund.
Senator, we're almost out of time, but really quickly to touch on vaping, lung injuries linked to vaping. They've killed nearly 26 people in recent months. You were recently at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin about this issue. Do you support a ban on vaping products as authorities investigate what's going on here?
Well, certainly, I very strongly support heightened government action to get to the bottom of this. And I had called on Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, to open an emergency operations center to track these and try to figure out which vaping devices or products are the cause of these really tragic lung diseases. Secondly, I think that action to restrict access to minors and to certainly ban these flavors that are absolutely targeted at young people would be very important interim steps.
Senator, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Tammy Baldwin is a U.S. Senator who's represented Wisconsin since 2013. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.